Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican Senate delaying their vote on the repeal and replacement of Obamacare that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was hoping to ram through before the 4th of July recess. A leading authority on healthcare and healthcare reform, Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, joins us. We will discuss the difficulty pleasing the demands of the libertarian wing who want to do away with any government role and the moderate Republican wing who don't want to see millions of citizens of their states lose healthcare coverage that they've only recently gained. We will look into the obvious truth about these bills that they are tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans at the expense of taking coverage away from our poorest citizens, and whether in the event that the Republicans get nothing done, we will be left with the probability that Obamacare will be slowly but surely undermined and killed by neglect and sabotage. Then we will speak with Marcia Gessen, the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She is now a contributing editor for The New York Times, where she has an article, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. We will discuss her critique of the four-hour-long interviews of Vladimir Putin that Oliver Stone made for Showtime, which were widely panned as a platform for Putin to parry sycophantic softball questions into a propaganda exercise. We'll also examine whether Putin's meddling in the U.S. election has backfired. And finally, we'll analyze a major shift in global attitudes about the United States reflected in the latest poll from the Pew Research Center that surveyed over 40,000 people in 37 countries to find that only two countries, Israel and Russia, have a better opinion of America under Trump, while 26 of the 37 countries consider Trump dangerous. Michael Fuchs, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State who was a special advisor to the Secretary of State and a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff, joins us to assess how far the U.S. has fallen in the estimation of the world since Trump became president. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thank you.
It looks as though the Senate has had to delay the healthcare vote. Mitch McConnell was trying to force it through before the 4th of July holiday. And now, of course, it'll mean that after Congress returns from the holiday, they'll have a two-week window before the summer break. But it's not looking good. Now, my understanding is that Trump has invited all of the Republican senators over to the White House for a strategy session. But I'm told by a lot of Washington insiders, and particularly in the Senate, that the senators don't want to be too associated with Trump. He's kind of kryptonite as far as this healthcare bill is concerned. So is that going to help, having them over at the White House?
Well, you know, when your approval ratings as a president are in the mid-30s or thereabouts, the amount of pressure you can exert on members of Congress is limited. And from the beginning, this was going to be difficult to get through the Senate because Republicans can only afford to lose two votes, and it's a very narrow margin. And Leader McConnell has to satisfy conservatives like Rand Paul from Kentucky and Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, and moderates or less conservative Republicans like Heller in Nevada and Susan Collins in Maine. So it's a difficult road to hoe, and it's been a roller coaster. But we should remember that in the House, of course, the bill died before it was passed as well. So the final chapter has not been written yet.
Well, in both the House and the Senate, it looks as though the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office's scoring of the bills, really did have a detrimental effect. It seems like 22 million people losing their health insurance has certainly turned Susan Collins around.
Well, it's, I guess, reassuring if evidence and facts matter and reason in this. And the bottom line, what the CBO is saying in non-technical terms is that the Republican Party does not have a viable replacement plan. They do not have a plan to replace Obamacare that can ensure anything like the number of people that the Affordable Care Act can. And you can see that in their scores. And if you read through the CBO report, what you see is that the Senate Republican plan really would offer people quite inadequate coverage. Many people would lose insurance, and the kind of plans that would be available for the uninsured to purchase, the deductibles would be so staggeringly high that low-income Americans simply couldn't afford them. So it's a bad plan, and I think the CBO report reflects that.
So are the Republicans victims of rhetoric? I mean, they're obviously, if they get anything passed, they're going to make a lot of Americans victims of their politics, because this is never going to improve what Obama did. But it would make sense, given the flaws of Obamacare, to try and fix it, make it better, make it work better, as opposed to scuttle it and come up with something that's infinitely worse. What do you attribute all this to? I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the real world, but it just seems like the American people, and particularly those who are going to lose their healthcare coverage, are victims of political posturing.
Republican Party in Congress has a visceral hatred of Obamacare, and they have been running against it since before it was passed. They have been campaigning to repeal it and fighting to undermine it for the past 7 years. And now they have a chance to do just that. And so part of this is a commitment to make good on their promise, as irrational as it is to actually carry that out. Part of it is partisan. Part of it is ideological, and this really reflects the ideological polarization in American politics. And Obamacare is, in key respects, a conservative plan. It looks a lot like what Republican health reform plans used to look like, and yet the Republican Party has moved so far to the right in Congress that now that plan is too liberal for them. And so part of it is that, and part of it is, I think, that Republicans the last 7 years have constructed an illusion of Obamacare, that Obamacare has destroyed American medical care, that everybody has lost their doctor and everybody's costs are going up and so forth. To be sure, there are real issues with Obamacare. There are real problems with it that absolutely need fixing. But it's also a fact that 20 million Americans have gained insurance coverage. It's also a fact that insurance companies have been prohibited from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, which is a huge change from what the status quo ante was. It's also a fact that in the 32 states that have expanded Medicaid, millions of low-income Americans who have gained coverage who simply couldn't afford it before. And their Republican illusion of Obamacare doesn't allow for these successes. And so when they go to strip Obamacare away, the idea is they're moving away from the system that's collapsing, the system that's dying. And the reality is very different. The reality is Obamacare is a flawed system, but has covered many people and has many successes. And as a result, Republicans are repealing something that means that millions of Americans are going to lose benefits.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. Now, we know that Bernie Sanders has come out for single payer, and now Elizabeth Warren has joined him, saying it's time for Democrats to run on a single payer healthcare platform across the country. And as you mentioned, Obamacare was based on a conservative model, Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts. I mean, the Republicans think this is wonderful. They say this is going to really tank the Democrats. They haven't exactly taken it up. Nancy Pelosi sort of said she's in favor of single payer, but has not wanted to champion it. What do you think the chances are of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren getting some traction here?
Well, I think it already has had traction. If you look in states like California, where there's a lot of momentum for single payer, certainly at the state level, this has caught fire in some states. And if you look at public opinion polls, there was a poll out, I think, from Pew just this past week showing that the percentage of Americans favoring single payer, while it's still a minority, and it, of course, depends on how you ask the question, it's jumped significantly among liberal Democrats. And so, you know, Elizabeth Warren, a potential presidential aspirant in 2020, it's significant that she's come out in favor of it, because single payer has not had a lot of support from establishment Democrats. And of course, Bernie Sanders ran for the Democratic nomination, but is actually not a Democrat. So I think it is going to gain traction in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. The question is, can it gain much beyond there? And there, I think it's going to be more difficult. It depends in part on what happens to Obamacare. If Republicans in the House and Senate, if the Senate passes something and Republicans in the House and Senate come to an agreement and they eviscerate much of Obamacare's insurance expansion, and if they make the kind of devastating cuts to Medicaid that are in both proposals that would adversely affect states and hospitals and physicians and millions of Americans who lose coverage, it will create more of an opening for single payer. I have no doubt about that. It will still be difficult to enact, but if the system sustains that kind of blow, there will be more of an opening. But in order for single payer to get beyond the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, it's got to reach a much broader audience, both in terms of the public and politically. And I think that remains the challenge for champions of Medicare for All.
But this Republican bill, whether it's the House or the Senate one, the one thing that's clear about both of them is that they're really about tax cuts for the rich. And what money they take away from Medicaid, they give back to the wealthiest Americans. And that's the one thing that survived in both bills. Again, I'm not sure whether that's the Democrats are able to make it that clear to the American people that that's what this is really about. But I've always been suspicious of the Ayn Rand kind of mentality of Paul Ryan, who seems to be, along with Mitch McConnell, enthralled with the very wealthy and willing to jump over hoops to do their bidding. I cannot understand why they feel they have such an obligation to the wealthiest Americans to give them.
That's definitely in the bill. If you look at the data from the Tax Policy Center about this, the top 1% of Americans would get 45%. Of the tax cuts in this repeal bill. And the top 0.1%, these are people who are making $5 million or more, would get an average tax cut of $250,000 in this bill. This, I may be wrong about this, but this is quite possibly the most regressive legislation in modern American political history. We have, of course, had laws before that have cut taxes for the wealthy, and we've had laws that have cut benefits for low-income Americans. I'm not sure, and since the New Deal, that we have ever had a piece of legislation that in the same bill has this magnitude of tax cuts to the wealthy and social benefit cuts to low-income Americans. And this really is an extraordinarily redistributive bill in that it takes the money that was being spent to help working Americans afford health insurance, takes that health insurance away from them, takes the subsidies away from them, takes Medicaid away from them, and gives that money to the wealthy in the form of tax cuts. It's absolutely a regressive bill of epic proportions.
But at this point, we don't know whether they're going to get away with it. But my understanding is that Ryan also wants to go after Medicare itself.
Well, this is, if you go back and, you know, it doesn't take much of a prophecy to predict this. All you have to do is go back and read Paul Ryan's budgets in 2011 and 2012, when he first put forward his budgets that contain all these elements, which is demolishing the Affordable Care Act, making devastating cuts in Medicaid, and attempting to privatize Medicare. That was in the original Ryan budget. He actually called for eliminating the government Medicare program and replacing it entirely with vouchers for private plans. In subsequent budgets, he had to back off that because of the political heat he took. But this has absolutely been on Paul Ryan's mind and his aspirations from the beginning. And this bill is only partly to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Much of this bill is designed to cut taxes for high-income Americans and to really devastate the Medicaid program. And let's remember that they're doing much more than rolling back the Medicaid expansion in the Affordable Care Act. They're proposing putting caps on Medicaid spending that are unprecedented in American political history, and that as each year went on, and the Congressional Budget Office report showed this, would hurt states more and more, and millions of people would lose Medicaid coverage as a result of these caps.
Well, just in closing, if they can't get their act together, they can still do an awful lot of damage. You know, as Ryan said a while back, Obamacare is still the law of the land. Well, if they can't get their act together, then won't they also spend the rest of the Trump's tenure, however long that might be, really undermining the law of the land if Obamacare still stays in place?
Yes, certainly the Trump administration has the ability to undermine Obamacare. They can do it by refusing to reimburse insurers for those cost-sharing reductions that help low-income people pay their deductibles and co-pays. If they do that, if they refuse to reimburse insurers, it could implode the individual insurance market in many states. So they could undermine the insurance exchanges. They could go the route of giving states waivers to impose work requirements on Medicaid enrollees and other kind of waivers. So there are lots of things that Congress and the Trump administration can do. This fight is not over, and we don't know yet what's going to happen in the Senate and what's going to happen in coming weeks. But you're correct that even if they fail, the longer-term battle over health reform and Obamacare is far from over.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, now in its second edition. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Marsha Geshen about her article at the New York Times, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marsha Geshen, a Russian-American journalist who served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Vladimir Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and her latest book about the Sonara brothers is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She's a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, where she has an article, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marsha Geshen.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start with this sort of confusion in American politics where the old Cold Warriors, even the Red Baiters on the conservative side, many of them now are making apologies for Putin, some suggest to protect Donald Trump. And on the left, a lot of people who are normally suspicious of the CIA are now counting on the CIA to find the smoking gun with which to impeach Donald Trump. And there are people on the left, particularly in the American left, like at The Nation magazine and others, that seem to equate any criticism of Vladimir Putin with McCarthyism, which is a strange charge. But what do you make of it? Because obviously Oliver Stone has taken the Putin issue so much further in the direction of not Putin bashing, as I get accused of doing by listeners on the left, but Putin worshipping.
And I don't think that Stephen Cohen, when he writes for The Nation, or Oliver Stone represent the mainstream of the American left. I'd like to not think that. But I think that, you know, when people on the left get into sort of conspiracy theories, then they meet up with the right, right, on that territory, right? A lot of all conspiracy theories are basically alike. And so that sort of brings people together. And we've seen that happen. You know, I think that Stone's logic and sentiment are peculiarly similar to Trump's logic and sentiment, precisely because they think of the world in terms of conspiracies. And they also think that the U.S. government is a great big conspiracy actor. And so whether they come at it from the right or from the left becomes almost irrelevant.
Well, one of the more extraordinary things that Oliver Stone said to Putin was he suggested that the American government only wants a compliant puppet in Russia, and essentially America rules the world and that's all they care about is vassal states. And by implication, this is when he was talking about how many assassination attempts that he had discussed with Castro. But the view of the United States is so extraordinary that, I mean, surely it's possible to be a progressive on domestic issues in the United States, but at least be a realist on foreign policy. But I don't understand this sort of anger at Uncle Sam and the assumption that America's behind everything that's wrong with the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible, and there's certainly people on the left who I think have a saner view of American foreign policy. And I think I would go further and say that it's possible to criticize American foreign policy and criticize it harshly without falling into the trap that Stone and Putin sort of reside in, which is basically interpreting every intention as a priori evil. You know, he has these shots of Victoria Nuland, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, talking about supporting NGOs, supporting civil society, and the way that he presents it is exactly the way that Russian television presents it, which is that it's on the face of it to them sinister, the idea of supporting civil society in these countries. I mean, that goes beyond any kind of criticism. I mean, it's just nuttiness.
Well, I think as far as I can tell from Oliver Stone's defense of himself, he was on Stephen Colbert and was somewhat ridiculed. And I think Colbert made the joke, did Putin have your dog in a cage? But in general, it seems that his excuse for these appallingly softball interviews with Putin was that you have to be polite. And it's true. I try to be polite. If I invite somebody on to have a discussion, I try to extract information without getting into an argument. But surely journalism is not about being polite, is it? I mean, isn't it about afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted?
Well, I mean, I also think that journalism, there are some very basic rules of journalism. And one of them, generally speaking, although it's not usually written because why would you write it? But generally speaking, as a journalist, you do not stage question and answers. And you do not ask questions that were scripted ahead of time for you. It is very clear that Stone repeatedly throughout the 4 hours of interviews asks questions that were handed to him by Putin's people. One of those questions is the question about the 5 assassinations. Stone says, so there have been 5 assassination attempts. Probably there have been more, but there are 5 legitimate ones that I found. And then Putin smiles and says, yes, 5 assassination attempts, more than Fidel Castro. And then he talks about talking to Castro about how to survive the dangerous office of president. The thing is, I performed a journalistic experiment. I tried to find 5 assassination attempts against Putin in publicly available sources, and it is not possible. There are not 5 assassination attempts that Oliver Stone, who doesn't seem to be much of a researcher because a lot of his stuff was wrong, but there's no way that he would have found 5 assassination attempts because that has never been part of sort of the Putin mythology until now. The Kremlin has now decided to communicate to the world that Putin is in grave danger. And so they gave Stone that question. And questions like that came up repeatedly. Specific figures that Stone would cite that are wrong, but happen to be figures that Putin agreed with. Like when he said that the US deficit was 18 trillion and that the Russian deficit was 1 trillion, which is not true. When he said that Putin had raised the average wage in Russia by a factor of 3, not true. But Putin readily agreed with those numbers because they had been given to Stone by Putin's people. So I don't think we can even call this journalism, even if we give him the politeness and even if we give him a lot of sort of leeway and say that maybe he's an inept journalist, but he wasn't actually performing journalism. Or what he was doing was performing, right? Mm. And what I think is really upsetting about this is that Showtime broadcast this as though it were journalism.
And again, I'm speaking with Marcia Gessen, a Russian-American journalist who served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Vladimir Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break, Cement the Passion of Pussy Riot. And her latest book about the Sonara Brothers is The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. She's a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, where she has an article, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. Well, what bothers me, and I, as I say, I get a lot of hate mail for covering what's going on with Russia and with Trump and all of these investigations, et cetera. And I think I have a pretty realistic view of Putin. Certainly, your book, Masha Gessen, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, is a must read for anybody who wants to get a primer on what they're dealing with here. But I just find it absolutely incomprehensible that people, you know, the left used to support human rights and they were the heroes of the oppressed around the world during the Cold War, etc. And surely the people we should be in solidarity with are these young Russian teenagers taking to the streets of all these Russian cities, having their heads cracked by the riot police. I mean, many of them are just in high school. That's where one's sympathy should be, surely. Not with this kleptocrat thug murderer in the Kremlin. You know, I mean, I just can't believe that given a choice between who you in solidarity with, it's a no-brainer, surely.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Although, I mean, I don't see what this has to do with the left, right? Mm-hmm. Oliver Stone has shown himself to be a morally corrupt and possibly otherwise corrupt, inept, dishonest human being, right? In this, he is not like the American left, which includes all sorts of people, but you can't generalize from him to talk about the left. Mm-hmm. In fact, in this, he is very much like the Trump administration, which is why I draw that link in the article. He is very much like the U.S. State Department under Rex Tillerson's leadership, which has failed to speak up in any meaningful way about the largest wave of arrests in Russia in decades. You know, not even during the later decades of the Soviet Union did these kinds of arrests take place, when more than 1,800 people were arrested for peaceful protest in a single day on June 12th. And some of them are going to go to jail for years, and some of them are being held for 30 days. And some of them were tortured. In the jail cells where they were taking. And where is the State Department, whose job it is, not just the moral obligation, which it is for all human beings, but whose job it is to stand up for human rights internationally?
Well, it's very hard. I mean, I'm using the term the left because I'm with a left-wing radio station, and my mail is mostly from people who really think that the U.S. government is pretty much wrong about everything, and somehow criticizing Putin is somehow reflection of McCarthyism. But right. You know, so I'm trying to understand why it is that this sympathy for this man exists at all, and particularly when you consider that he is, in the American political lexicon, the closest person you could find to him would be, because he's a religious nationalist, a white nationalist. I guess, you know, I don't mean to insult some of these evangelicals in this country, but that's about as far to the right you can get in American politics, a white nationalist evangelical. And that's pretty much where Putin is. He hates gays, etc., and is obviously very racist, and seems to have – the only person I can think about in the Trump administration who has similar views is Stephen Bannon. But again, why would anybody who – I mean, is this some sort of vestige of the Cold War that somehow people haven't figured out that Putin and Russia are no longer a socialist country?
Yeah. You know, I think that it's a vestige of the whole Cold War in a different sense, in the sense that it's just thoughtless politics, right? Whatever you stand for, I stand for the opposite of everything that you stand for, right? And so if the U.S. government is criticizing Russia for its human rights record, then I am going to not criticize Russia for its human rights record and call it McCarthyism. But, you know, during the Cold War, as distasteful as some of the rhetoric of the Cold War was, a lot of it was based on reality. and practicing thoughtless politics in during the Cold War or in the 1930s, which some people on the American left did, landed them right in the arms of Stalin. Right. So that always happens if you don't think about your politics beyond placing yourself in opposition to whoever you're opposing on every count without considering every count separately. You know, I mean, I think that intelligent people not only can but have an obligation to have to hold complicated opinions and to hold complicated views. And you can, be opposed to many of the policies of the American government, and at the same time, be opposed to Vladimir Putin.
Well, indeed, you can have two thoughts in your head at the same time. You can consider Edward Snowden both a hero and a traitor.
Exactly. And, you can consider him a hero and a traitor and a lost boy and somebody who's also done damage to his reputation by being in Russia. You can have four of those thoughts in your head at the same time.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Marcia Gessen, I wanted to turn to where you think this Russian story is going. It's obviously got Donald Trump quite apoplectic. Apparently he's somewhat haunted like a character out of King Lear, wandering around the family quarters of the White House to the wee hours of the morning, furious about looking at video at taped cable news shows, and some of his friends apparently are worried about his health because he gets on the phone to them and calls them up in the wee hours of the morning and vents about feeling persecuted by this story. You were always pretty skeptical about it, and obviously people like Carter Page, who was just interviewed by the FBI, it's hard to take them seriously. My understanding is that people like Ivanov, the former Putin's former chief of staff, who was a very senior intelligence officer and very seasoned. My sense about Putin is that he was kind of a KGB wannabe. He was never in any of the important capitals like London, New York, and other NATO capitals. And that he did have some counsel from some more seasoned and worldly advisors like his chief of staff. And my understanding is that they warned him against this interfering in the U.S. election. They thought there'd be some blowback, which there clearly has been. Just in the broadest sense, my sense of what Putin has done is that he's been too clever by half. I don't think this is working out well for him at all. And certainly, if you can make the case, well, he wants America to be weak. Well, we have the weakest president we've ever had, and the situation gets worse and worse by the day, and he's barely been in office more than 160 days. So you could make that argument that if he wanted to weaken America, then he's got the perfect candidate in Donald Trump. But in general, what's your take on it? Do you think that he is this brilliant, clever guy, or is he just one a sort of small-time intelligence officer who's bitten off more than he can chew?
He's definitely not a brilliant, scheming guy. I think that an important thing to keep in mind as we try to figure out what happened in the lead-up to the election was that absolutely everybody, including President Obama, Putin, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, all were acting on the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win. Russian meddling was based on that assumption. Putin never expected Trump to actually win the election. He actually went to great lengths to, after all the criticism that he had leveled at Hillary Clinton, to backpedal a little bit during his annual shindig for foreign researchers and journalists, because he was convinced that a few weeks after that, she was going to be elected president of the United States. Obama didn't make a public statement about Russian interference because he was convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And of course, the two candidates were convinced that they were going to win. So, we can sort of start evaluating the story if we forget to keep that assumption. Putin wasn't planning for a Trump America. He was being disruptive, which is something that Russia has done for years in Western Europe and the United States, and used to do when it was the Soviet Union. Right? It's just there's never been this incredible coincidence. And I would still claim that it's a coincidence. It's a coincidence of efforts, right? Mm-hmm. But which is not to say that Russians didn't hack the DNC. They most certainly did, right? But they didn't actually elect Donald Trump. Americans elected Donald Trump. And now we have this incredibly messy picture with a disturbingly large part of the population focusing on this theory, this Russian theory, because they hope that it takes care of everything. It explains how we got Donald Trump, and it explains how we're going to get rid of him, because once it all comes to light, he's going to magically disappear. And in fact, it doesn't explain how we got Donald Trump, and it doesn't explain how we're going to get rid of him, because he is not going to magically disappear, because impeachment is not going to happen unless they at least flip the House, which they're not doing because they're focusing on this Russia story.
Well, Marcia Gessen, I thank you for that analysis, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Marcia Gessen, who's a Russian-American journalist who served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and was fired as editor of Around the World for not covering Vladimir Putin's stunt of flying with cranes. Her books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Her latest book is about the Sonarov brothers, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. And she's a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, where she has an article, How Putin Seduced Oliver Stone and Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the latest poll from the Pew Research Center that finds only two countries, Israel and Russia, have a better opinion of America under Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and he also managed the State Department's foreign assistance budget of almost $800 million and was a special advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues and served as a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff. He also worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
It's great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Michael. And I was calling you because I wanted to get an opinion on the Pew Research Center have just done an international survey. They've interviewed more than 40,000 people in 37 countries to find out how the rest of the world is viewing Donald Trump's presidency. And they've concluded that he's had a major impact on how the world sees the United States. And the survey shows that only two of the 37 countries that they investigated have a better opinion of Mr. Trump than they had of his predecessor, Barack Obama. And those two countries are Israel and Russia. The rest, to varying degrees, have very negative opinions. Some of them, 26 of the 37 countries, consider Mr. Trump dangerous. So something's happened, right?
Absolutely. I'd say this is a pretty stunning rebuke of the new American president in just a span of 5 months in office. If you look at the polling, it differentiates the questions that they asked people in those 37 countries between what they think of the U.S. president, Donald Trump himself, and what they think about their country's relationships with the United States. And the differences in those answers are stark. While both of them have gone significantly down, those that believe that the relationships between their countries and the United States will be good is much higher than those who believe that the U.S. president is good or is a reliable leader. What that basically means is that confidence in these countries in the president himself as a leader, as an individual, is stunningly low, even though many people in some of these countries still have a certain amount of faith in the bilateral relationships they have with the United States.
Well, specifically, Germany, 86% of Germans had faith in Barack Obama, but only 11% of Germans now have faith in Donald Trump. That's a pretty extraordinary drop.
No, it's, again, absolutely stunning. And I think that, again, one of the most important takeaways that I have from this polling is how much the president himself and people's views of him and how irresponsible and, as you said, dangerous he potentially is driving this drop in support for the United States and its policies. You know, if you go back 8 years and you see what the opinion polls around the world were of the United States and its leadership at the end of the George W. Bush presidency, there are a few countries that actually come close to these low levels of approval ratings. And that was after years of U.S.-led war in Iraq that was highly unpopular, as well as in the midst of the global financial crisis that many viewed as being started in the United States. Only after those catastrophes did the public opinion polling in many countries around the world reach rock-bottom levels of the United States and George W. Bush. It took Donald Trump 5 months to achieve those levels, and in many cases, worse levels in support from around the world after Barack Obama had brought them way back up.
Well, specifically, we mentioned Israel as one of the few countries that feel better about America under Trump than they did under Obama. The Russians, 53% of Russians are generally optimistic about the world with Trump in the White House. That's, I think, given the way the media operates there, that would, you know, reflect pretty much Putin's point of view, since he controls the media. But I don't know where that's going, and I don't know that you or I or anybody knows where this Russian story is going, do we?
No, I don't think so. But the evidence of smoke, if not fire, continues to mount, it seems. The contacts, obviously, that the Trump campaign had with Russia during the Russian attempt to interfere in the 2016 election just keeps growing. Hints that Donald Trump himself may have been involved in one way or another. And then on top of it all, the signals that Trump himself continues to send about his concern over this investigation into the potential collusion by firing the FBI director Comey and consistently trying to discredit the investigation being conducted by former FBI Director Mueller just keeps making it seem as though that there is more and more smoke, which means that maybe there's a fire there. But, you know, this is clearly an area of mounting concern for the president. And it just goes to show how odd this U.S.-Russia dynamic is right now, as you just pointed out, where opinion polling in Russia of the United States is gone way up. And similarly, if you look actually in the United States, oddly enough, the opinion polling of Republicans and conservatives in the United States, their support for Vladimir Putin and Russia has oddly flipped on its head and gone way up.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues, and also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He co-authored with Morton Halperin The Survival and the Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy. Now, the other country, of course, that's somewhat, it's not a majority opinion, but at least a little more favorable than the rest of the countries, is India. They have a 40% favorable opinion of Donald Trump compared to 58% for Barack Obama. And of course, Modi was just visiting on Monday the White House. What do you think that's about? Because the travel ban is certainly, I mean, it's going to go into effect on Thursday, but it's certainly got a lot of the Islamic world upset and insulted, frankly. Could there be a relationship there, given the animus that the Indians have towards Pakistan and in the sense that there's a kind of religious dimension to that?
Well, I think the only reason, or I think a large part of the reason why the opinion of Donald Trump in India has not plummeted the same level it has in many other places in the world, in particular in U.S. allies, is because of exactly that, that India is not a U.S. ally. When you look at the U.S.-India relationship, there are very strong bonds between the American and the Indian people, over 3 million Indians, people of Indian descent in the United States. And that level of people-to-people engagement keeps the relationship, I think, very strong and views of the United States very strong, while at the same time, the opinions of U.S. policy don't quite have that same level of high expectations that they always do or frequently do in places like Europe or some countries in Asia that are allies of the United States. And so there's perhaps a little bit more of a middle ground that'll always be kept relatively even in terms of opinions of the United States in India. But I do think that you've seen a drop, as you pointed out, 58% to 40%, which is a pretty significant drop. That's one third drop in support for the U.S. president. And I do think that that has a lot to do, actually, with the immigration ban and President Trump's policy agenda. Many Indians right now are scared of actually coming to the United States. They've seen attacks in the United States on Indian Americans, on Americans of Indian descent, on Indians traveling to the United States that are scaring them and actually raising questions in the minds of Indians and Indian students as well about whether or not they should actually come to the United States. And I think that's driving a fair amount of the concern, you know, you see in this public opinion polling.
Well, and certainly unpopular with Muslim populations, particularly this ban that has just, in most part, been approved by the Supreme Court and will be implemented on Monday. And of course, a lot of people cannot believe that the country from which 15 of the 19 hijackers came, Saudi Arabia, is not on the list, and everybody else. And I'm noticing this Pew Research study about how the world sees Donald Trump. Jordan disapproves of Trump to the extent of 96%. I mean, that's a very key ally. Jordan, particularly in the context of the war against the Islamic State right next door in both Iraq and Syria.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that this has obviously long been a problem for the United States, is the way in which the people of the Middle East view the United States and its policies, the longstanding alliance relationship with Israel by the United States has obviously hurt, I think, the U.S. public image in the eyes of many in the Arab world and in the broader Middle East. I think that it's very possible that Donald Trump's policies to date, which have been relatively aggressive in the Middle East, he has done a very quick job of trying to forge close relationships with the leaders in these countries. And I think we have to remember that the leaders in these countries who are not democratically elected, such as King Abdullah in Jordan, are oftentimes not very popular, or in some cases very unpopular with their people. And this has been one of the longstanding complaints by people in the Middle East about U.S. policy in the region, is that it focuses on the leaders and forging relationships with the leadership and the elites in these countries and not with the people in mind. And that may very well be part of what we are seeing here right now. And it is really just taking what has always been a very, very difficult set of relationships for the United States in that region, perhaps to a very new low, on par or maybe even below the levels that we saw of the United States during the height of the Iraq War.
Well, already I think there are indications that Donald Trump is having an effect on elections for leaders abroad. In Germany, virtually everybody that's running, including Angela Merkel, are in effect running against Donald Trump. And the British Prime Minister, who called an election, Theresa May, thinking she'd get increase her narrow majority, really got slammed. And a lot of analysts in the UK say that she didn't distance herself sufficiently from Donald Trump because he's so deeply unpopular with the British people, and not to mention the German people. And I imagine the same is true also in France.
Well, I think that it's absolutely true that we see two things happening. One is there is, without a doubt, a stronger surge for these populist, nationalist movements in a lot of countries, not just in the United States, obviously, but also in Europe. I think it's also true, as you pointed out, that many of these leaders in countries in Western Europe and in particular see Donald Trump as a liability for them politically, and are trying to distance themselves from him to make sure that they are not hurt at the polls. But I think also at the same time, it is important to remember that all of these countries are very different and have their own unique politics here. Donald Trump plays a part in them, but probably a very small part here. I also would note that in the last couple of elections in Europe, that people were watching as supposed barometers for whether or not there was a Trump-like wave in Europe of populist nationalism actually failed, both in the Netherlands, where Geert Wilder was defeated at the polls, a right-wing nationalist there. Similarly, Marine Le Pen in France also went down to defeat overwhelmingly by now President Macron. And so I do think that you have seen not just how different each of these countries are in terms of their politics and the sort of Trump effect, if you will, but also the fact that these populist nationalist surges are not necessarily overwhelming. They're not necessarily things that are going to win the day. And frankly, many people in the center and on the left are pushing back very hard against them, not just in Europe, but frankly also as we've seen in the United States.
Well, but it's still possible, is it? Or is there any suggestion here that Donald Trump is giving white nationalism a bad name?
I think white nationalism has a pretty bad name all on its own.
Right, but in other words, is he dragging down Le Pen and these other people's numbers because of the obvious association with him? I mean, is he even unpopular with the far right? That would be my question.
Well, you know, again, I think it's very, very difficult to tell. I think that obviously, again, there is a Trump effect to a certain extent in some of these countries right now, where the opponents of the far right in many of these European countries are clearly coalescing around opposition candidates, around candidates that represent the more center or center left parties in their countries. Perhaps that in and of itself is a Trump effect, if you will, in opposition to the president, much as you've seen, frankly, much of the galvanized political activity in the United States just in the last 5 months. And so I think that it's entirely possible. But I do, again, think that each of these countries is very, very different. And, of course, it is, I think, very popular to sort of look at you know, the Brexit vote to the election of Donald Trump and beyond, and see a bunch of dots connecting very nicely about the surge of nationalism and populism in these countries. And without a doubt, there's some truth to that. But I do also think that the picture is much more complex here, and lots of these countries are dealing with a variety of different complex issues that are playing out in their politics. And I think that the example of Macron right now is a really great example. Maybe it is a pushback against Donald Trump, but maybe it is a combination of other forces as well. But not only was he able to win the presidency with a brand new political party, but he just swept in victory afterwards in parliamentary elections with candidates from his brand new party. I mean, something not seen in a while, at least as far as I can remember, in European politics. And so I do think that you are, at the very least, seeing a resurgence, at least this year so far, in some of the center and center-left movements.
Just in the last minute then, Michael Fuchs, Donald Trump, of course, has placed a great deal of hope and trust in his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and touted him as the great negotiator. And he went across to the Middle East to solve the ultimate Gordian knot, the Israeli-Palestinian long-standing dispute. And apparently he was such a catastrophe that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, basically threw him out of his office and was furious that he was there basically as Netanyahu's messenger boy. I mean, the guy is so close to Netanyahu and his family are that when Netanyahu stayed with his parents at their home in New Jersey, Jared would give up his bedroom for Netanyahu. So, I mean, on the surface, you'd think, you know, that's hardly a neutral party. What do you make of this? I mean, it seems like amateur land got run amok.
I think that's exactly right. You know, the amount of power and responsibility that has supposedly been placed with Jared Kushner when it comes to certain aspects of U.S. foreign policy. We've heard similar stories about his, you know, taking over the China relationship, as well as other policy areas, domestic and foreign. I think first and foremost, this is just wrongheaded. It's amateurish, as you put it. This is someone who doesn't have any foreign policy experience whatsoever, doesn't have the relationships or the knowledge. And so that is the first mistake. But the second big mistake here, of course, is exactly as you pointed out, which is you're putting someone who appears to be, and is at the very least perceived to be, incredibly close with one side in a two-sided negotiation. The United States has always gone in to try to facilitate and help foster progress in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and has always done its level best to try to make it clear to both that it is an objective facilitator and observer in this process. And you put someone in the middle of that process to try to facilitate it who clearly, as you pointed out, is very close to the Israeli prime minister. And this sort of result shouldn't be surprising.
Well, Michael Fuchs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was the special advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogue, and also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. He's the co-author with Morten Harperin of The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.